His four trips from the United States to see Senguin and his family in Lebanon, he had always traveled with a round-trip ticket. When Gerard departed Miami on July 25th, Atta appears to have driven him to the airport, another unique circumstance. Bin al-Shib picked up Gerard at the airport in Dusseldorf on July 25th. Gerard wanted to see Senguin as soon as possible, so he and Bin al-Shib arranged to meet a few days later. When they did, they had an emotional conversation, during which Bin al-Shib encouraged Gerard to see the plan through. While Gerard was in Germany, Bin al-Shib and Moussaoui were in contact to arrange for the transfer of funds. Bin al-Shib received two wire transfers from Hausaoui in the UAE, totaling $15,000, and, within days, relayed almost all of this money to Moussaoui in two installments. Moussaoui had been taking flight lessons at the Airman Flight School in Norman, Oklahoma, since February, but stopped in late May. Although at that point he had only about 50 hours of flight time and no solo flights to his credit, Moussaoui began making inquiries about flight materials and simulator training for Boeing 747s. On July 10th, he put down a $1,500 deposit for flight simulator training at Pan Am International Flight Academy in Eagan, Minnesota, and by the end of the month, he had received a simulator schedule to train from August 13th through August 20th. Moussaoui also purchased two knives and inquired of two manufacturers of GPS equipment whether their products could be converted for aeronautical use, activities that closely resembled those of the 9/11 hijackers during their final preparations for the attacks. On August 11th, shortly after getting the money from Bin al-Shib, Moussaoui left Oklahoma with a friend and drove to Minnesota. 3 days later, Moussaoui paid the $6,800 balance owed for his flight simulator training at Pan Am in cash and began his training. His conduct, however, raised the suspicions of his flight instructor. It was unusual for a student with so little training to be learning to fly large jets without any intention of obtaining a pilot's license or other goal. On August 16th, once the instructor reported his suspicion to the authorities, Moussaoui was arrested by the INS on immigration charges. KSM denies ever considering Moussaoui for the plane's operation. Instead, he claims that Moussaoui was slated to participate in a second wave of attacks. KSM also states that Moussaoui had no contact with Atta, and we are unaware of evidence contradicting this assertion. Yet KSM has also stated that by the summer of 2001, he was too busy with the plane's operation to continue planning for any second wave attacks. Moreover, he admits that only three potential pilots were ever recruited for the alleged second wave: Moussaoui plus two others who, by mid-summer of 2001, had backed out of the plot. We therefore believe that the effort to push Moussaoui forward in August 2001 lends credence to the suspicion that he was being primed as a possible pilot in the immediate planes operation. Bin al-Shib says he assumed Moussaoui was to take his place as another pilot in the 9/11 operation. Recounting a post-9/11 discussion with KSM in Kandahar, Bin al-Shib claims KSM mentioned Moussaoui as being part of the 9/11 operation. Although KSM never referred to Moussaoui by name, Bin al-Shib understood he was speaking of the operative to whom Bin al-Shib had wired money. Bin al-Shib says KSM did not approve of Moussaoui, but believes KSM did not remove him from the operation only because Moussaoui had been selected and assigned by Bin Laden himself. KSM did not hear about Moussaoui's arrest until after September 11th. According to Bin al-Shib, had Bin Laden and KSM learned prior to 9/11 that Moussaoui had been detained, they might have canceled the operation. When Bin al-Shib discussed Moussaoui's arrest with KSM after September 11th, KSM congratulated himself on not having Moussaoui contact the other operatives, which would have compromised the operation. Moussaoui had been in contact with Bin al-Shib, of course, but this was not discovered until after 9/11. As it turned out, Moussaoui was not needed to replace Gerard. By the time Moussaoui was arrested in mid-August, Gerard had returned to the United States from his final trip to Germany, his disagreement with Atta apparently resolved. The operatives began their final preparation for the attacks. Readying the attacks. A week after he returned from meeting Bin al-Shib in Spain, Atta traveled to Newark, probably to coordinate with Hazmi and give him additional funds. Atta spent a few days in the area before returning to Florida on July 30th. The month of August was busy, as revealed by a set of contemporaneous Atta-Bin al-Shib communications that were recovered after September 11th. On August 3rd, for example, Atta and Bin al-Shib discussed several matters, such as the best way for the operatives to purchase plane tickets and the assignment of muscle hijackers to individual teams. Atta and Bin al-Shib also revisited the question of whether to target the White House. They discussed targets in coded language, pretending to be students discussing various fields of study. Architecture referred to the World Trade Center, arts, the Pentagon, law, the Capitol, and politics, the White House. Bin al-Shib reminded Atta that bin Laden wanted to target the White House. Atta again cautioned that this would be difficult. When bin al-Shib persisted, Atta agreed to include the White House, but suggested they keep the Capitol as an alternate target in case the White House proved too difficult. Atta also suggested that the attacks would not happen until after the first week in September, when Congress reconvened. Atta and bin al-Shib also discussed the friend who is coming as a tourist, a cryptic reference to candidate hijacker Mohammed al-Qahtani, mentioned above, whom Hawzawi was sending the next day as the last one to complete the group. On August 4th, Atta drove to the Orlando airport to meet Qahtani. Upon arrival, however, Qahtani was denied entry by immigration officials because he had a one-way ticket and little money, could not speak English, and could not adequately explain what he intended to do in the United States. He was sent back to Dubai. Hawzawi contacted KSM, who told him to help Qahtani return to Pakistan. On August 7th, Atta flew from Fort Lauderdale to Newark, probably to coordinate with Hazmi. 2 days later, Ahmed al-Ghamdi and Abdul Aziz al-Omari, who had been living in New Jersey with Hazmi and Hanjour, flew to Miami, probably signifying that the four hijacking teams had finally been assigned. While Atta was in New Jersey, he, Hazmi, and Hanjour all purchased tickets for another set of surveillance flights. Like Shehi, Jarrah, Atta, and Walid al-Sheri before them, Hazmi and Hanjour each flew in first class on the same type of aircraft they would hijack on 9/11, a Boeing 757, and on transcontinental flights that connected to Las Vegas. By this time, however, Atta himself also flew directly to Las Vegas, where all three stayed on August 13th and 14th. Beyond Las Vegas's reputation for welcoming tourists, we have seen no credible evidence explaining why, on this occasion and others, the operatives flew to or met in Las Vegas. Through August, the hijackers kept busy with their gym training and the pilots took frequent practice flights on small rental craft. The operatives also began to make purchases, suggesting that the planning was coming to an end. In mid-August, for example, they bought small knives that may actually have been used in the attacks. On August 22nd, moreover, Jarrah attempted to purchase four GPS units from a pilot shop in Miami. He was able to buy only one unit, which he picked up a few days later when he also purchased three aeronautical charts. Perhaps most significant, however, was the purchase of plane tickets for September 11th. On August 25th, Atta again flew to Newark, probably to meet with Hazmi and select flights. All 19 tickets were booked and purchased between August 25th and September 5th. It therefore appears that the attack date was selected by the third week of August. This timing is confirmed by bin al-Shib, who claims Atta called him with the date in mid-August. According to bin al-Shib, Atta used a riddle to convey the date in code, a message of two branches, a slash, and a lollipop. To non-Americans, 11/9 would be interpreted as September 11th. Bin al-Shib says that he called Atta back to confirm the date before passing it to KSM. KSM apparently received the date from bin al-Shib in a message sent through bin al-Shib's old Hamburg associate, Zakaria Essebar. Both bin al-Shib and KSM claim that Essebar was not privy to the meaning of the message and had no foreknowledge of the attacks. According to bin al-Shib, shortly after the date was chosen, he advised Essebar and another Hamburg associate, Saeed Bahaji, that if they wanted to go to Afghanistan, now was the time, because it would soon become more difficult. Essebar made reservations on August 22nd and departed Hamburg for Karachi on August 30th. Bahaji purchased his tickets on August 20th and departed Hamburg for Karachi on September 3rd. Bin al-Shib also made arrangements to leave for Pakistan during early September, before the attacks, as did Ali and Hawzawi, the plot facilitators in the UAE. During these final days, bin al-Shib and Atta kept in contact by phone, email, and instant messaging. Although Atta had forbidden the hijackers to contact their families, he apparently placed one last call to his own father on September 9th. Atta also asked bin al-Shib to contact the family of one hijacker, pass along goodbyes from others, and give regards to KSM. Jarrah alone appears to have left a written farewell, a sentimental letter to Aysel Sengwen. Hazmi, however, may not have been so discreet. He may have telephoned his former San Diego companion, Modar Abdullah, in late August. Several bits of evidence indicate that others in Abdullah's circle may have received word that something big would soon happen. As noted earlier, Abdullah's behavior reportedly changed noticeably. Prior to September 11th, both he and Yazid al-Salmi suddenly became intent on proceeding with their planned marriages. One witness quotes Salmi as commenting after the 9/11 attacks, "I knew they were going to do something. That is why I got married." Moreover, as of August 2001, Iyad Krywesh and other employees at the Texaco station where Hazmi had worked suddenly were anticipating attention from law enforcement authorities in the near future. Finally, according to an uncorroborated witness account, early on the morning of September 10th, Abdullah Osama Awadalla, Omar Bakar Bashat, and others behaved suspiciously at the gas station. According to the witness, after the group met, Awadalla said, "It is finally going to happen," as the others celebrated by giving each other high fives. Dissent within the Al-Qaeda leadership. While tactical preparations for the attack were nearing completion, the entire operation was being questioned at the top, as Al-Qaeda and the Taliban argued over strategy for 2001. Our focus has naturally been on the specifics of the planes operation, but from the perspective of bin Laden and Atef, this operation was only one, admittedly key, element of their unfolding plans for the year. Living in Afghanistan, interacting constantly with the Taliban, the Al-Qaeda leaders would never lose sight of the situation in that country. Bin Laden's consistent priority was to launch a major attack directly against the United States. He wanted the planes operation to proceed as soon as possible. Midar reportedly told his cousin during the summer of 2001 that bin Laden was reputed to have remarked, "I will make it happen, even if I do it by myself." According to KSM, bin Laden had been urging him to advance the date of the attacks. In 2000, for instance, KSM remembers bin Laden pushing him to launch the attacks amid the controversy after then-Israeli opposition party leader Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. KSM claims bin Laden told him it would be enough for the hijackers simply to down planes rather than crash them into specific targets. KSM says he resisted the pressure. KSM claims to have faced similar pressure twice more in 2001. According to him, bin Laden wanted the operation carried out on May 12, 2001, 7 months to the day after the Kohl bombing. KSM adds that the 9/11 attacks had originally been envisioned for May 2001. The second time he was urged to launch the attacks early was in June or July 2001, supposedly after bin Laden learned from the media that Sharon would be visiting the White House. On both occasions, KSM resisted, asserting that the hijacking teams were not ready. Bin Laden pressed particularly strongly for the latter date in two letters stressing the need to attack early. The second letter was reportedly delivered by bin Laden's son-in-law, Aus al-Madani. Other evidence corroborates KSM's account. For instance, Midar told his cousin that the attacks were to happen in May, but were postponed twice, first to July, then to September. Moreover, one candidate hijacker remembers a general warning being issued in the Al-Qaeda camps in July or early August, just like the warnings issued 2 weeks before the Kohl bombing and 10 days before the eventual 9/11 attacks. During the midsummer alert, Al-Qaeda members dispensed with their families, security was increased, and bin Laden disappeared for about 30 days until the alert was canceled. While the details of the operation were strictly compartmented, by the time of the alert, word had begun to spread that an attack against the United States was coming. KSM notes that it was generally well known by the summer of 2001 that he was planning some kind of operation against the United States. Many were even aware that he'd been preparing operatives to go to the United States, leading some to conclude that Al-Qaeda was planning a near-term attack on U.S. soil. Moreover, bin Laden had made several remarks that summer hinting at an upcoming attack and generating rumors throughout the worldwide jihadist community. Bin Laden routinely told important visitors to expect significant attacks against U.S. interests soon, and, during a speech at the Al-Farouk camp, exhorted trainees to pray for the success of an attack involving 20 martyrs. Others have confirmed hearing indications of an impending attack and have verified that such news, albeit without specific details, had spread across Al-Qaeda. Although bin Laden's top priority apparently was to attack the United States, others had a different view. The Taliban leaders put their main emphasis on the year's military offensive against the Northern Alliance, an offensive that ordinarily would begin in the late spring or summer. They certainly hoped that this year's offensive would finally finish off their old enemies, driving them from Afghanistan. From the Taliban's perspective, an attack against the United States might be counterproductive. It might draw the Americans into the war against them just when final victory seemed within their grasp. There is evidence that Mullah Omar initially opposed a major Al-Qaeda operation directly against the United States in 2001. Furthermore, by July, with word spreading of a coming attack, a schism emerged among the senior leadership of al-Qaeda. Several senior members reportedly agreed with Mullah Omar. Those who reportedly sided with bin Laden included Atef, Suleiman Abu Ghaith, and KSM. But those said to have opposed him were weighty figures in the organization, including Abu Hafs the Mauritanian, Sheikh Saeed al-Masri, and Saif al-Adl. One senior al-Qaeda operative claims to recall bin Laden arguing that attacks against the United States needed to be carried out immediately to support insurgency in the Israeli-occupied territories and protest the presence of U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia. Beyond these rhetorical appeals, bin Laden also reportedly thought an attack against the United States would benefit al-Qaeda by attracting more suicide operatives, eliciting greater donations, and increasing the number of sympathizers willing to provide logistical assistance. Mullah Omar is reported to have opposed this course of action for ideological reasons rather than out of fear of U.S. retaliation. He is said to have preferred for al-Qaeda to attack Jews, not necessarily the United States. KSM contends that Omar faced pressure from the Pakistani government to keep al-Qaeda from engaging in operations outside Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda's chief financial officer, Sheikh Saeed, argued that al-Qaeda should defer to the Taliban's wishes. Another source says that Sheikh Saeed opposed the operation, both out of deference to Omar and because he feared the U.S. response to an attack. Abu Hafs the Mauritanian reportedly even wrote bin Laden a message, basing opposition to the attacks on the Quran. According to KSM, in late August, when the operation was fully planned, bin Laden formally notified the al-Qaeda Shura Council that a major attack against the United States would take place in the coming weeks. When some council members objected, bin Laden countered that Mullah Omar lacked authority to prevent al-Qaeda from conducting jihad outside Afghanistan. Though most of the Shura Council reportedly disagreed, bin Laden persisted. The attacks went forward. The story of dissension within al-Qaeda regarding the 9/11 attacks is probably incomplete. The information on which the account is based comes from sources who were not privy to the full scope of al-Qaeda and Taliban planning. But bin Laden and Atef, however, probably would have known at least that the general Taliban offensive against the Northern Alliance would rely on al-Qaeda military support. Another significant al-Qaeda operation was making progress during the summer, a plot to assassinate the Northern Alliance leader, Ahmed Shah Massoud. The operatives, disguised as journalists, were in Massoud's camp and prepared to kill him sometime in August. Their appointment to see him was delayed. But on August 9th, the Massoud assassination took place. The delayed Taliban offensive against the Northern Alliance was apparently coordinated to begin as soon as he was killed, and it got underway on September 10th. As they deliberated earlier in the year, bin Laden and Atef would likely have remembered that Mullah Omar was dependent on them for the Massoud assassination and for vital support in the Taliban military operations. KSM remembers Atef telling him that al-Qaeda had an agreement with the Taliban to eliminate Massoud, after which the Taliban would begin an offensive to take over Afghanistan. Atef hoped Massoud's death would also appease the Taliban when the 9/11 attacks happened. There are also some scant indications that Omar may have been reconciled to the 9/11 attacks by the time they occurred. Moving to departure positions. In the days just before 9/11, the hijackers returned leftover funds to al-Qaeda and assembled in their departure cities. They sent the exec funds by wire transfer to Hawsawi in the UAE, about $26,000 altogether. The hijackers targeting American Airlines Flight 77 to depart from Dulles migrated from New Jersey to Laurel, Maryland, about 20 miles from Washington, D.C. They stayed in a motel during the first week in September and spent time working out at a gym. On the final night before the attacks, they lodged at a hotel in Herndon, Virginia, close to the airport. Further north, the hijackers targeting United Airlines Flight 93 to depart from Newark gathered in that city from their base in Florida on September 7th. Just after midnight on September 8th and 9th, Jarrah received a speeding ticket in Maryland as he headed north on I-95. He joined the rest of his team at their hotel. Atta was still busy coordinating the teams. On September 7th, he flew from Fort Lauderdale to Baltimore, presumably to meet with the Flight 77 team in Laurel. On September 9th, he flew from Baltimore to Boston. By then, Shehi had arrived there, and Atta was seen with him at his hotel. The next day, Atta picked up Omari at another hotel, and the other two drove down to Portland, Maine, for reasons that remain unknown. In the early morning hours of September 11th, they boarded a commuter flight to Boston to connect to American Airlines Flight 11. The two spent their last night pursuing ordinary activities, making ATM withdrawals, eating pizza, and shopping at a convenience store. Their three fellow hijackers for Flight 11 stayed together in a hotel in Newton, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. Shehi and his team, targeting United Airlines Flight 175 from Logan Airport, spent their last hours at two Boston hotels. The plan that started with a proposal by KSM in 1996 had evolved to overcome numerous obstacles. Now, 19 men waited in nondescript hotel rooms to board four flights the next morning.
Chapter 8. The System Was Blinking Red. Section 8.1. The Summer of Threat. As 2001 began, counterterrorism officials were receiving frequent but fragmentary reports about threats. Indeed, there appeared to be possible threats almost everywhere the United States had interests, including at home. To understand how the escalation in threat reporting was handled in the summer of 2001, it is useful to understand how threat information in general is collected and conveyed. Information is collected through several methods, including signals intelligence and interviews of human sources, and gathered into intelligence reports. Depending on the source and nature of the reporting, these reports may be highly classified and therefore tightly held, or less sensitive and widely disseminated to state and local law enforcement agencies. Threat reporting must be disseminated either through individual reports or through threat advisories. Such advisories, intended to alert their recipients, may address a specific threat or be a general warning. Because the amount of reporting is so voluminous, only a select fraction can be chosen for briefing the president and senior officials. During 2001, Director of Central Intelligence George Tenet was briefed regularly regarding threats and other operational information relating to Osama bin Laden. He in turn met daily with President Bush, who was briefed by the CIA through what is known as the President's Daily Brief, the PDB. Each PDB consists of a series of 6 to 8 relatively short articles or briefs covering a broad array of topics. CIA staff decides which subjects are the most important on any given day. There were more than 40 intelligence articles in the PDBs from January 20th to September 10th, 2001, that related to bin Laden. The PDB is considered highly sensitive and is distributed to only a handful of high-level officials. The Senior Executive Intelligence Brief, SEIB, distributed to a broader group of officials, has a similar format and generally covers the same subjects as the PDB. It usually contains less information so as to protect sources and methods. Like their predecessors, the Attorney General, the FBI Director, and Richard Clark, the National Security Council, NSC Counterterrorism Coordinator, all received the SEIB, not the PDB. Clark and his staff had extensive access to terrorism reporting, but they did not have access to internal, non-disseminated information at the National Security Agency, NSA, CIA, or FBI. The drumbeat begins. In the spring of 2001, the level of reporting on terrorist threats and planned attacks increased dramatically to its highest level since the Millennium Alert. At the end of March, the intelligence community disseminated a terrorist threat advisory, indicating a heightened threat of Sunni extremist terrorist attacks against U.S. facilities, personnel, and other interests. On March 23rd, in connection with discussions about possibly reopening Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House, Clark warned National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice that domestic or foreign terrorists might use a truck bomb, their weapon of choice, on Pennsylvania Avenue. That would result, he said, in the destruction of the West Wing and parts of the residence. He also told her he thought there were terrorist cells within the United States, including Al-Qaeda. The next week, Rice was briefed on the activities of Abu Zubaydah and on the CIA efforts to locate him. As pointed out in Chapter 6, Abu Zubaydah had been a major figure in the Millennium Plots. Over the next few weeks, the CIA repeatedly issued warnings, including calls from DCI Tenet to Clark, that Abu Zubaydah was planning an attack in the near future. One report cited a source that indicated that Abu Zubaydah was planning an attack in a country that CIA analysts thought might be Israel or perhaps Saudi Arabia or India. Clark relayed these reports to Rice. In response to these threats, the FBI sent a message to all its field offices on April 13th, summarizing reporting to date. It asked the offices to task all resources, including human sources and electronic databases, for any information pertaining to current operational activities relating to Sunni extremism. It did not suggest that there was a domestic threat. The Interagency Counterterrorism Security Group, CSG, that Clark chaired, discussed the Abu Zubaydah reports on April 19th. The next day, a briefing to top officials reported bin Laden planning multiple operations. When the deputies discussed al-Qaeda policy on April 30th, they began with a briefing on the threat. In May 2001, the drumbeat of reporting grew louder with reports to top officials that bin Laden public profile may presage attack and bin Laden network's plans advancing. In early May, a walk-in to the FBI claimed there was a plan to launch attacks on London, Boston, and New York. Attorney General John Ashcroft was briefed by the CIA on May 15th regarding al-Qaeda generally and the current threat reporting specifically. The next day brought a report that a phone call to a U.S. embassy had warned that bin Laden supporters were planning an attack in the United States using high explosives. On May 17th, based on the previous day's report, the first item on the CSG's agenda was UBL, Operation Planned in U.S. The anonymous caller's tip could not be corroborated. Late May brought reports of a possible hostage plot against Americans abroad to force the release of prisoners, including Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, the blind sheikh, who was serving a life sentence for his role in the 1993 plot to blow up sites in New York City. The reporting noted that operatives might opt to hijack an aircraft or storm a U.S. embassy. This report led to a Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, information circular to airlines noting the potential for an airline hijacking to free terrorists incarcerated in the United States. Other reporting mentioned that Abu Zubaydah was planning an attack, possibly against Israel, and expected to carry out several more if things went well. On May 24th alone, counterterrorism officials grappled with reports alleging plots in Yemen and Italy, as well as a report about a cell in Canada that an anonymous caller had claimed might be planning an attack against the United States. Reports similar to many of these were made available to President Bush in morning intelligence briefings with DCI Tenet, usually attended by Vice President Dick Cheney and National Security Advisor Rice. While these briefings discussed general threats to attack America and American interests, the specific threats mentioned in these briefings were all overseas. On May 29th, Clark suggested that Rice ask DCI Tenet what more the United States could do to stop Abu Zubaydah from launching a series of major terrorist attacks, probably on Israeli targets, but possibly on U.S. facilities. Clark wrote to Rice and her deputy, Stephen Hadley, "When these attacks occur, as they likely will, we will wonder what more we could have done to stop them." In May, CIA Counterterrorist Center, CTC, Chief Kofor Black told Rice that the current threat level was a 7 on a scale of 1 to 10, as compared to an 8 during the millennium. High probability of near-term spectacular attacks. Threat reports surged in June and July, reaching an even higher peak of urgency. The summer threats seemed to be focused on Saudi Arabia, Israel, Bahrain, Kuwait, Yemen, and possibly Rome, but the danger could be anywhere, including a possible attack on the G8 summit in Genoa. A June 12th CIA report passing along biographical background information on several terrorists mentioned, in commenting on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that he was recruiting people to travel to the United States to meet with colleagues already there so that they might conduct terrorist attacks on bin Laden's behalf. On June 22nd, the CIA notified all its station chiefs about intelligence suggesting a possible al-Qaeda suicide attack on a U.S. target over the next few days. DCI Tenet asked that all U.S. ambassadors be briefed. That same day, the State Department notified all embassies of the terrorist threat and updated its worldwide public warning. In June, the State Department initiated the Visa Express program in Saudi Arabia as a security measure in order to keep long lines of foreigners away from vulnerable embassy spaces. The program permitted visa applications to be made through travel agencies instead of directly at the embassy or a consulate. A terrorist threat advisory distributed in late June indicated a high probability of near-term spectacular terrorist attacks resulting in numerous casualties. Other reports' titles warned, "Bin Laden attacks may be imminent," and "Bin Laden and associates making near-term threats." The latter reported multiple attacks planned over the coming days, including a severe blow against U.S. and Israeli interests during the next 2 weeks. On June 21st, near the height of the threat reporting, U.S. Central Command raised the force protection condition level for U.S. troops in 6 countries to the highest possible level, Delta. The U.S. Fifth Fleet moved out of its port in Bahrain, and a U.S. Marine Corps exercise in Jordan was halted. U.S. embassies in the Persian Gulf conducted an emergency security review, and the embassy in Yemen was closed. The CSG had foreign emergency response teams, known as FESTs, ready to move on 4 hours' notice and kept up the terrorism alert posture on a rolling 24-hour basis. On June 25th, Clark warned Rice and Hadley that 6 separate intelligence reports showed al-Qaeda personnel warning of a pending attack. An Arabic television station reported bin Laden's pleasure with al-Qaeda leaders who were saying that the next weeks will witness important surprises and that U.S. and Israeli interests will be targeted. Al-Qaeda also released a new recruitment and fundraising tape. Clark wrote that this was all too sophisticated to be merely a psychological operation to keep the United States on edge, and the CIA agreed. The intelligence reporting consistently described the upcoming attacks as occurring on a calamitous level, indicating that they would cause the world to be in turmoil and that they would consist of possible multiple, but not necessarily simultaneous, attacks. On June 28th, Clark wrote Rice that the pattern of al-Qaeda activity indicating attack planning over the past 6 weeks had reached a crescendo. A series of new reports continue to convince me and analysts at State, CIA, DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and NSA that a major terrorist attack or series of attacks is likely in July, he noted. One al-Qaeda intelligence report warned that something very, 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 very big was about to happen, and most of bin Laden's network was reportedly anticipating the attack. In late June, the CIA ordered all its station chiefs to share information on al-Qaeda with their host governments and to push for immediate disruption of cells. The headline of a June 30th briefing to top officials was stark: Bin Laden planning high-profile attacks. The report stated that bin Laden operatives expected near-term attacks to have dramatic consequences of catastrophic proportions. That same day, Saudi Arabia declared its highest level of terror alert. Despite evidence of delays possibly caused by heightened U.S. security, the planning for attacks was continuing. On July 2nd, the FBI Counterterrorism Division sent a message to federal agencies and state and local law enforcement agencies summarizing information regarding threats from bin Laden. It warned that there was an increased volume of threat reporting, indicating a potential for attacks against U.S. targets abroad from groups aligned with or sympathetic to Osama bin Laden. Despite the general warnings, the message further stated, the FBI has no information indicating a credible threat of terrorist attack in the United States. However, it went on to emphasize that the possibility of attack in the United States could not be discounted. It also noted that the July 4th holiday might heighten the threats. The report asked recipients to exercise extreme vigilance and report suspicious activities to the FBI. It did not suggest specific actions that they should take to prevent attacks. Disruption operations against al-Qaeda-affiliated cells were launched involving 20 countries. Several terrorist operatives were detained by foreign governments, possibly disrupting operations in the Gulf and Italy, and perhaps averting attacks against 2 or 3 U.S. embassies. Clark and others told us of a particular concern about possible attacks on the 4th of July. After it passed uneventfully, the CSG decided to maintain the alert. To enlist more international help, Vice President Cheney contacted Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah on July 5th. Hadley apparently called European counterparts while Clark worked with senior officials in the Gulf. In late July, because of threats, Italy closed the airspace over Genoa and mounted anti-aircraft batteries at the Genoa airport during the G8 summit, which President Bush attended. At home, the CSG arranged for the CIA to brief intelligence and security officials from several domestic agencies. On July 5th, representatives from the Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, the FAA, the Coast Guard, the Secret Service, Customs, the CIA, and the FBI met with Clark to discuss the current threat. Attendees report that they were told not to disseminate the threat information they received at the meeting. They interpreted this directive to mean that although they could brief their superiors, they could not send out advisories to the field. An NSC official recalls a somewhat different emphasis, saying that attendees were asked to take the information back to their home agencies and do what you can with it, subject to classification and distribution restrictions. A representative from the INS asked for a summary of the information that she could share with field offices. She never received one. That same day, the CIA briefed Attorney General Ashcroft on the Al-Qaeda threat, warning that a significant terrorist attack was imminent. Ashcroft was told that preparations for multiple attacks were in late stages or already complete, and that little additional warning could be expected. The briefing addressed only threats outside the United States. The next day, the CIA representative told the CSG that Al-Qaeda members believe the upcoming attack would be spectacular, qualitatively different from anything they had done to date. Apparently, as a result of the July 5th meeting with Clark, the Interagency Committee on Federal Building Security was tasked to examine security measures. This committee met on July 9th, when 37 officials from 27 agencies and organizations were briefed on the current threat level in the United States. They were told that not only the threat reports from abroad, but also the recent convictions in the East Africa bombings trial, the conviction of Ahmed Rassam, and the just-returned Khobar Towers indictments reinforced the need to exercise extreme vigilance. Attendees were expected to determine whether their respective agencies needed enhanced security measures. On July 18, 2001, the State Department provided a warning to the public regarding possible terrorist attacks in the Arabian Peninsula. Acting FBI Director Thomas Pickard told us he had one of his periodic conference calls with all special agents in charge on July 19th. He said one of the items he mentioned was the need, in light of increased threat reporting, to have evidence response teams ready to move at a moment's notice in case of an attack. He did not task field offices to try to determine whether any plots were being considered within the United States or to take any action to disrupt any such plots. In mid-July, reporting started to indicate that bin Laden's plans had been delayed, maybe for as long as 2 months, but not abandoned. On July 23rd, the lead item for CSG discussion was still the Al-Qaeda threat, and it included mention of suspected terrorist travel to the United States. On July 31st, an FAA circular appeared alerting the aviation community to reports of possible near-term terrorist operations, particularly on the Arabian Peninsula and or Israel. It stated that the FAA had no credible evidence of specific plans to attack U.S. civil aviation, though it noted that some of the currently active terrorist groups were known to plan and train for hijackings and were able to build and conceal sophisticated explosive devices in luggage and consumer products. Tenet told us that in his world the system was blinking red. By late July, Tenet said it could not get any worse. Not everyone was convinced. Some asked whether all these threats might just be deception. On June 30th, the SCIB contained an article titled Bin Laden Threats Are Real. Yet Hadley told Tenet in July that Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz questioned the reporting. Perhaps bin Laden was trying to study U.S. reactions. Tenet replied that he had already addressed the Defense Department's questions on this point. The reporting was convincing. To give a sense of his anxiety at the time, one senior official in the Counter-Terrorist Center told us that he and a colleague were considering resigning in order to go public with their concerns. The calm before the storm. On July 27th, Clark informed Rice and Hadley that the spike in intelligence about a near-term Al-Qaeda attack had stopped. He urged keeping readiness high during the August vacation period, warning that another report suggested an attack had just been postponed for a few months but will still happen. On August 1st, the FBI issued an advisory that in light of the increased volume of threat reporting and the upcoming anniversary of the East Africa embassy bombings, increased attention should be paid to security planning. It noted that although most of the reporting indicated a potential for attacks on U.S. interests abroad, the possibility of an attack in the United States could not be discounted. On August 3rd, the intelligence community issued an advisory concluding that the threat of impending Al-Qaeda attacks would likely continue indefinitely. Citing threats in the Arabian Peninsula, Jordan, Israel, and Europe, the advisory suggested that Al-Qaeda was lying in wait and searching for gaps in security before moving forward with the planned attacks. During the spring and summer of 2001, President Bush had on several occasions asked his briefers whether any of the threats pointed to the United States. Reflecting on these questions, the CIA decided to write a briefing article summarizing its understanding of this danger. Two CIA analysts involved in preparing this briefing article believed it represented an opportunity to communicate their view that the threat of a bin Laden attack in the United States remained both current and serious. The result was an article in the August 6th Presidential Daily Brief titled, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S." It was the 36th PDB item briefed so far that year that related to bin Laden or al-Qaeda, and the first devoted to the possibility of an attack in the United States. The president told us the August 6th report was historical in nature. President Bush said the article told him that al-Qaeda was dangerous, which he said he had known since he had become president. The president said bin Laden had long been talking about his desire to attack America. He recalled some operational data on the FBI and remembered thinking it was heartening that 70 investigations were underway. As best he could recollect, Rice had mentioned that the Yemenis' surveillance of a federal building in New York had been looked into in May and June, but there was no actionable intelligence. He did not recall discussing the August 6th report with the Attorney General or whether Rice had done so. He said that if his advisors had told him there was a cell in the United States, they would have moved to take care of it. That never happened. Although the following day's SEIB repeated the title of this PDB, it did not contain the reference to hijackings, the alert in New York, the alleged casing of buildings in New York, the threat phoned into the embassy, or the fact that the FBI had approximately 70 ongoing bin Laden-related investigations. No CSG or other NSC meeting was held to discuss the possible threat of a strike in the United States as a result of this report. The following is the text of an item from the Presidential Daily Brief received by President George W. Bush on August 6, 2001. Redacted material will be indicated by brackets in the text, indicated here in the audio as well. Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. Clandestine, foreign government, and media reports indicate bin Laden since 1997 has wanted to conduct terrorist attacks in the U.S. Bin Laden implied in U.S. television interviews in 1997 and 1998 that his followers would follow the example of World Trade Center bomber Ramzi Youssef and bring the fighting to America. After U.S. missile strikes on his base in Afghanistan in 1998, bin Laden told followers he wanted to retaliate in Washington, according to a redacted service. An Egyptian Islamic Jihad, EIJ operative, told an, section redacted, service at the same time that bin Laden was planning to exploit the operative's access to the U.S. to mount a terrorist strike. The Millennium Plotting in Canada in 1999 may have been part of bin Laden's first serious attempt to implement a terrorist strike in the U.S. Convicted plotter Ahmed Rassam has told the FBI that he conceived the idea to attack Los Angeles International Airport himself, but that bin Laden Lieutenant Abu Zubaydah encouraged him and helped facilitate the operation. Rassam also said that in 1998, Abu Zubaydah was planning his own U.S. attack. Rassam says bin Laden was aware of the Los Angeles operation. Although bin Laden has not succeeded, his attacks against the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998 demonstrate that he prepares operations years in advance and is not deterred by setbacks. Bin Laden associates surveilled our embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam as early as 1993, and some members of the Nairobi cell planning the bombings were arrested and deported in 1997. Al-Qaeda members, including some who are U.S. citizens, have resided in or traveled to the U.S. for years, and the group apparently maintains a support structure that could aid attacks. Two Al-Qaeda members found guilty in the conspiracy to bomb our embassies in East Africa were U.S. citizens, and a senior EIJ member lived in California in the mid-1990s. A clandestine source said in 1998 that a bin Laden cell in New York was recruiting Muslim American youth for attacks. We have not been able to corroborate some of the more sensational threat reporting, such as that from a section redacted service in 1998, saying that bin Laden wanted to hijack a U.S. aircraft to gain the release of blind Sheikh Umar Abd al-Rahman and other U.S.-held extremists. Nevertheless, FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. The FBI is conducting approximately 70 full-field investigations throughout the U.S. that it considers bin Laden-related. CIA and the FBI are investigating a call to our embassy in the UAE in May, suggesting that a group of bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attacks with explosives. That's section from the Daily PDB, August 6th. Late in the month, a foreign service reported that Abu Zubaydah was considering mounting terrorist attacks in the United States after postponing possible operations in Europe. No targets, timing, or method of attack were provided. We have found no indication of any further discussion before September 11th among the president and his top advisors of the possibility of a threat of an al-Qaeda attack in the United States. DCI Tenet visited President Bush in Crawford, Texas on August 17th and participated in PDB briefings of the president between August 31st, after the president had returned to Washington, and September 10th. But Tenet does not recall any discussions with the president of the domestic threat during this period. Most of the intelligence community recognized in the summer of 2001 that the number and severity of threat reports were unprecedented. Many officials told us that they knew something terrible was planned, and they were desperate to stop it. Despite their large number, the threats received contained few specifics regarding time, place, method, or target. Most suggested that attacks were planned against targets overseas. Others indicated threats against unspecified U.S. interests. We cannot say for certain whether these reports, as dramatic as they were, related to the 9/11 attacks. Government response to the threats. National Security Advisor Rice told us that the CSG was the nerve center for running the crisis, although other senior officials were involved over the course of the summer. In addition to his daily meetings with President Bush and weekly meetings to go over other issues with Rice, Tenet was speaking regularly with Secretary of State Colin Powell and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. The foreign policy principals routinely talked on the telephone every day on a variety of topics. Hadley told us that before 9/11, he and Rice did not feel they had the job of coordinating domestic agencies. They felt that Clark and the CSG, part of the NSC, were the NSC's bridge between foreign and domestic threats. There was a clear disparity in the levels of response to foreign versus domestic threats. Numerous actions were taken overseas to disrupt possible attacks, enlisting foreign partners to upset terrorist plans, closing embassies, moving military assets out of the way of possible harm. Far less was done domestically, in part, surely, because to the extent that specifics did exist, they pertained to threats overseas. As noted earlier, a threat against the embassy in Yemen quickly resulted in its closing. Possible domestic threats were more vague. When reports did not specify where the attacks were to take place, officials presumed that they would again be overseas, though they did not rule out a target in the United States. Each of the FBI threat advisories made this point. Clark mentioned to National Security Advisor Rice at least twice that al-Qaeda sleeper cells were likely in the United States. In January 2001, Clark forwarded a strategy paper to Rice warning that al-Qaeda had a presence in the United States. He noted that two key al-Qaeda members in the Jordanian cell involved in the Millennium Plot were naturalized U.S. citizens and that one jihadist suspected in the East Africa bombings had informed the FBI that an extensive network of al-Qaeda sleeper agents currently exists in the United States. He added that Rassam's abortive 1999 attack in December revealed al-Qaeda supporters in the United States. His analysis, however, was based not on new threat reporting, but on past experience. The September 11th attacks fell into the void between the foreign and domestic threats. The foreign intelligence agencies were watching overseas, alert to foreign threats to U.S. interests there. The domestic agencies were waiting for evidence of a domestic threat from sleeper cells within the United States. No one was looking for a foreign threat to domestic targets. The threat that was coming was not from sleeper cells, it was foreign, but from foreigners who had infiltrated into the United States. A second cause of this disparity in response is that domestic agencies did not know what to do, and no one gave them direction. Cressy told us that the CSG did not tell the agencies how to respond to the threats. He noted that the agencies that were operating overseas did not need direction on how to respond. They had experience with such threats and had a playbook. In contrast, the domestic agencies did not have a game plan. Neither the NSC, including the CSG, nor anyone else instructed them to create one. This lack of direction was evident in the July 5th meeting with representatives from the domestic agencies. The briefing focused on overseas threats. The domestic agencies were not questioned about how they planned to address the threat and were not told what was expected of them. Indeed, as noted earlier, they were specifically told they could not issue advisories based on their briefing. The domestic agency's limited response indicates that they did not perceive a call to action. Clark reflected a different perspective in an email to Rice on September 15, 2001. He summarized the steps taken by the CSG to alert domestic agencies to the possibility of an attack in the United States. Clark concluded that domestic agencies, including the FAA, knew that the CSG believed a major al-Qaeda attack was coming and could be in the United States. Although the FAA had authority to issue security directives mandating new security procedures, none of the few that were released during the summer of 2001 increased security at checkpoints or onboard aircraft. The information circulars mostly urged air carriers to exercise prudence and be alert. Prior to 9/11, the FAA did present a CD-ROM to air carriers and airport authorities describing the increased threat to civil aviation. The presentation mentioned the possibility of suicide hijackings, but said that fortunately we have no indication that any group is currently thinking in that direction. The FAA conducted 27 special security briefings for specific air carriers between May 1, 2001 and September 11, 2001. Two of these briefings discussed the hijacking threat overseas. None discussed the possibility of suicide hijackings or the use of aircraft as weapons. No new security measures were instituted. Rice told us she understood that the FBI had asked its 56 U.S. field offices to increase surveillance of suspected terrorists and to reach out to informants who might have information about terrorist plots. An NSC staff document at the time described such a tasking as having occurred in late June, but does not indicate whether it was generated by the NSC or the FBI. Other than the previously described April 13th communication sent to all FBI field offices, however, the FBI could not find any record of having received such a directive. The April 13th document asking field offices to gather information on Sunni extremism did not mention any possible threat within the United States and did not order surveillance of suspected operatives. The NSC did not specify what the FBI's directives should contain and did not review what had been issued earlier. Acting FBI Director Picard told us that in addition to his July 19th conference call, he mentioned the heightened terrorist threat in individual calls with the special agents in charge of federal offices during their annual performance review discussions. In speaking with agents around the country, we found little evidence that any such concerns had reached FBI personnel beyond the New York field office. The head of counterterrorism at the FBI, Dale Watson, said he had many discussions about possible attacks with Kofor Black at the CIA. They had expected an attack on July 4th. Watson said he felt deeply that something was going to happen, but he told us the threat information was nebulous. He wished he had known more. He wished he had had 500 analysts looking at Osama bin Laden threat information instead of two. Attorney General Ashcroft was briefed by the CIA in May and by Picard in early July about the danger. Picard said he met with Ashcroft once a week in late June through July and twice in August. There is a dispute regarding Ashcroft's interest in Picard's briefings about the terrorist threat situation. Picard told us that after two such briefings, Ashcroft told him that he did not want to hear about the threats anymore. Ashcroft denies Picard's charge. Picard says he continued to present terrorism information during further briefings that summer, but nothing further on the chatter the U.S. government was receiving. The Attorney General told us he asked Picard whether there was intelligence about attacks in the United States and that Picard said no. Picard said he replied that he could not assure Ashcroft that there would be no attacks in the United States, although the reports of threats were related to overseas targets. Ashcroft said he therefore assumed the FBI was doing what it needed to do. He acknowledged that in retrospect this was a dangerous assumption. He did not ask the FBI what it was doing in response to the threats and did not task it to take any specific action. He also did not direct the INS, then still part of the Department of Justice, to take any specific action. In sum, the domestic agencies never mobilized in response to the threat. They did not have direction and did not have a plan to institute. The borders were not hardened. Transportation systems were not fortified. Electronic surveillance was not targeted against a domestic threat. State and local law enforcement were not marshaled to augment the FBI's efforts. The public was not warned. The terrorists exploited deep institutional failings within our government. The question is whether extra vigilance might have turned up an opportunity to disrupt the plot. As seen in Chapter 7, Al-Qaeda's operatives made mistakes. At least two such mistakes created opportunities during 2001, especially in late August. Section 8.2. Late Leads, Midhar, Mousawi, KSM. In Chapter 6, we discussed how intelligence agencies successfully detected some of the early travel in the planes operation, picking up the movements of Khalid al-Midhar and identifying him, and seeing his travel converge with someone they perhaps could have identified but did not, Nawaf al-Hazmi, as well as with less easily identifiable people such as Khalid and Abu Bara. These observations occurred in December 1999 and January 2000. The trail had been lost in January 2000 without a clear realization that it had been lost and without much effort to pick it up again. Nor had the CIA placed Midhar on the State Department's watch list for suspected terrorists, so that either an embassy or a port of entry might take note if Midhar showed up again. On four occasions in 2001, the CIA, the FBI, or both, had apparent opportunities to refocus on the significance of Hazmi and Midhar and reinvigorate the search for them. After reviewing those episodes, we will turn to the handling of the Mousawi case and some late leads regarding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. January 2001, Identification of Khalid. Almost 1 year after the original trail had been lost in Bangkok, the FBI and the CIA were working on the investigation of the Cole bombing. They learned of the link between a captured conspirator and a person called Khalid. They also learned that Khalid was a senior security official for bin Laden who had helped direct the bombing. We introduced Khalid in Chapter 5 and returned to his role in the Cole bombing in Chapter 6. One of the members of the FBI's investigative team in Yemen realized that he had heard of Khalid before from a joint FBI-CIA source 4 months earlier. The FBI agent obtained from a foreign government a photo of the person believed to have directed the Cole bombing. It was shown to the source, and he confirmed that the man in the photograph was the same Khalid he had described. In December 2000, on the basis of some links associated with Khalid al-Midhar, the CIA's bin Laden unit speculated that Khalid and Khalid al-Midhar might be one and the same. The CIA asked that a Kuala Lumpur surveillance photo of Midhar be shown to the joint source who had identified Khalid. In early January 2001, two photographs from the Kuala Lumpur meeting were shown to the source. One was a known photograph of Midhar, the other a photograph of a then unknown subject. The source did not recognize Midhar, but he indicated he was 90% certain that the other individual was Khalid. This meant that Khalid and Midhar were two different people. It also meant that there was a link between Khalid and Midhar, making Midhar seem even more suspicious. Yet we found no effort by the CIA to renew the long-abandoned search for Midhar or his travel companions. In addition, we found that the CIA did not notify the FBI of this identification. DCI Tenet and Kofor Black testified before Congress's joint inquiry into 9/11 that the FBI had access to this identification from the beginning. But drawing on an extensive record, including documents that were not available to the CIA personnel who drafted that testimony, we conclude this was not the case. The FBI's primary Cole investigators had no knowledge that Khalid had been in Kuala Lumpur with Midhar and others until after the September 11th attacks. Because the FBI had not been informed in January 2000 about Midhar's possession of a U.S. visa, it had not then started looking for him in the United States. Because it did not know of the links between Khalid and Midhar, it did not start looking for him in January 2001. This incident is an example of how day-to-day gaps in information sharing can emerge even when there is mutual goodwill. The information was from a joint FBI-CIA source who spoke essentially no English and whose languages were not understood by the FBI agent on the scene overseas. Issues of travel and security necessarily kept short the amount of time spent with the source. As a result, the CIA officer usually did not translate either questions or answers for his FBI colleague and friend. For interviews without simultaneous translation, the FBI agent on the scene received copies of the reports that the CIA disseminated to other agencies regarding the interviews. But he was not given access to the CIA's internal operational reports, which contained more detail. It was there, in reporting to which FBI investigators did not have access, that information regarding the January 2001 identification of Khalid appeared. The CIA official does not recall this particular identification and thus cannot say why it was not shared with his FBI colleague. He might not have understood the possible significance of the new identification. In June 2000, Midhar left California and returned to Yemen. It is possible that if, in January 2001, the CIA had resumed its search for him, placed him on the State Department's tip-off watch list, or provided the FBI with the information, he might have been found either before or at the time he applied for a new visa in June 2001, or when he returned to the United States on July 4. Spring 2001, looking again at Kuala Lumpur. By mid-May 2001, as the threat reports were surging, a CIA official detailed to the International Terrorism Operations Section at the FBI wondered where the attacks might occur. We will call him John. Recalling the episode about the Kuala Lumpur travel to Midhar and his associates, John searched the CIA's databases for information regarding the travel. On May 15th, he and an official at the CIA re-examined many of the old cables from early 2000, including the information that Midhar had a U.S. visa and that Hazmi had come to Los Angeles on January 15th, 2000. The CIA official who reviewed the cables took no action regarding them. John, however, began a lengthy exchange with a CIA analyst, whom we will call Dave, to figure out what these cables meant. John was aware of how dangerous Khalid was, at one point calling him a major league killer. He concluded that something bad was definitely up. Despite the U.S. links evident in this traffic, John made no effort to determine whether any of these individuals was in the United States. He did not raise that possibility with his FBI counterpart. He was focused on Malaysia. John described the CIA as an agency that tended to play a zone defense. He was worrying solely about Southeast Asia, not the United States. In contrast, he told us, the FBI tends to play man-to-man. Desk officers at the CIA's Bin Laden unit did not have cases in the same sense as an FBI agent who works an investigation from beginning to end. Thus, when the trail went cold after the Kuala Lumpur meeting in January 2000, the desk officer moved on to different things. By the time the March 2000 cable arrived with information that one of the travelers had flown to Los Angeles, the case officer was no longer responsible for follow-up. While several individuals at the Bin Laden unit opened the cable when it arrived in March 2000, no action was taken. The CIA's zone defense concentrated on where, not who. Had its information been shared with the FBI, a combination of the CIA's zone defense and the FBI's man-to-man approach might have been productive. June 2001, the meeting in New York. John's review of the Kuala Lumpur meeting did set off some sharing of information, getting the attention of an FBI analyst whom we will call Jane. Jane was assigned to the FBI's Cole investigation. She knew that another terrorist involved in that operation, Fald Alkuso, had traveled to Bangkok in January 2000 to give money to Khalid. Jane and the CIA analyst, Dave, had been working together on coal-related issues. Chasing Kuso's trail, Dave suggested showing some photographs to FBI agents in New York who were working on the coal case and had interviewed Kuso. John gave three Kuala Lumpur surveillance pictures to Jane to show to the New York agents. She was told that one of the individuals in the photograph was someone named Khalid Al-Midhar. She did not know why the photographs had been taken or why the Kuala Lumpur travel might be significant, and she was not told that someone had identified Khalid in the photographs. When Jane did some research in a database for intelligence reports, IntelInc, she found the original NSA reports on the planning for the meeting. Because the CIA had not disseminated reports on its tracking of Midhar, Jane did not pull up any information about Midhar's U.S. visa or about travel to the United States by Hazmi or Midhar. Jane, Dave, and an FBI analyst who was on detail to the CIA's Bin Laden unit went to New York on June 11th to meet with the agents about the Cole case. Jane brought the surveillance pictures. At some point in the meeting, she showed the photographs to the agents and asked whether they recognized Cusso in any of them. The agents had questions about the photographs. Why were they taken? Why were these people being followed? Where are the rest of the photographs? The only information Jane had about the meeting, other than the photographs, were the NSA reports that she had found on Intel Inc. These reports, however, contained caveats that their contents could not be shared with criminal investigators without the permission of the Justice Department's Office of Intelligence Policy and Review, OIPR. Therefore, Jane concluded that she could not pass on information from those reports to the agents. This decision was potentially significant because the signals intelligence she did not share linked